fix anything to...
I don't think it resolves it necessarily.
The House Interim Committee on Revenue will come to order.
The Senate Interim Committee on Finance and Revenue will come to order. Good morning, everyone, for this special edition of the quarterly economic forecast. Special and somewhat bittersweet because it is the final economic forecast facilitated and presided by Legislative Revenue Officer Dr. Paul Warner. And we'll have more on that at the end of this forecast, so stay tuned. In the meantime, we'll call up Mark McMullen and Josh Lerner. And in the background, we have State Economist Emeritus Tom Petowski standing by. We'll check for errors. Gentlemen.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. For the record, I'm Mark McMullen, Oregon State Economist, joined as always by my colleague Josh Lerner. Yeah, Chairman Haas is right. This is a particularly emotional and bittersweet revenue forecast, given that we're losing Paul. You know, you can remember what it was like to get temporary lost as a child, when you're at a store and you're looking at something and you turn around and your parents have moved on. That moment of panic and fear, you know, you have before, you know. It's when we got that announcement, boy, that's really how we felt, you know, because, you know, Paul is, you know, he's really the grandfather of our office, having done it himself for 10 years, and, you know, he's really proven to be a great mentor and protector to us over the time. So we're just as panicked about his leaving, maybe even more so. With our parents, we could always go around the corner to the next aisle and we'd find him, but they didn't ever just take off to Bend when they were done. Nevertheless, we'll have a couple more comments on that as well. But farewell, Paul, farewell. So in terms of the economic update, we'll go quickly through this. It's very much along the spirit of what we gave 3 months ago in terms of the recent performance of the economy. For those of you who are, you know, follow the numbers closely in the news, we'll talk a little bit more about this later, but you can kind of don't worry too much about the goofy monthly preliminary employment numbers we've been seeing coming out recently. We think that those will look more normal once they get revised and the final numbers come. But overall, the narrative and the picture is the same as last time. I know you all are familiar with this chart where we compare employment growth in Oregon to that of the U.S. And while employment growth in Oregon has steadily been slowing over the last couple of years, we're still outperforming the U.S. and job gains are still healthy. We're still expanding. We're bigger than ever and expanding. It's just at a slower rate. And it's a slower rate because we're starting to run into these capacity constraints, particularly in our big population centers, where employers are having a hard time expanding, either particularly in finding workers right now because the labor market is so tight, but also in getting supplies and land and the like in order to expand their production. So things have slowed. And in the Portland metropolitan area, it's particularly pronounced, down to 1% year-over-year job growth, which is really unheard of for the area. But that said, while this tight labor market and these capacity constraints are slowing the overall rate of growth, it also allows some positive things to happen. The fact that we're having, you know, starting to run into these capacity constraints, and in particular, we're starting to see these gains from the economy becoming more broad-based, being spread out across the regions of the state and across different income levels of folks. Income levels, as employers have to look farther down the list of candidates in order to get one, you know, we're starting to get more growth in the low income level. We're starting to bring a lot of people off the sidelines and the like. But also, as companies are starting to look outside of the costly population centers that are really hard to expand in now, we're starting to see job growth spread across the state. This map is showing comparing job growth today with job growth 2 years ago. And whereas all our major population centers are really slowing down, or for the most part, most of our population centers have slowed down considerably since the peak of Oregon's overall expansion, a lot of our more distressed and smaller rural areas are starting to pick up. Now, not all of these have recovered fully, and many haven't recovered all the job losses that they've had, unlike our population centers, which have. But nevertheless, they are accelerating and growing faster now than they were a couple years ago. So this narrative that we have about the overall economic expansion starting to feel these capacity constraints, starting to hit the growing pains and slowing down, that's not true across all regions of the state. And in fact, we're really starting to see more broad-based gains. And that was confirmed in the most recent mid-year population estimates coming out of the Portland State University, where now we're seeing that every single county in Oregon added population in 2017. And this is really what makes our rural areas stand out relative to other rural areas across the U.S. that may be having similar issues with being chained to traditional resource and manufacturing industries and the like, where we see places in the Rust Belt and the Farm Belt and the like, when they start losing their core resource, agriculture, or manufacturing industries, they lose population too. When those jobs go, so too do the workers. In Oregon, we have a little bit of a different dynamic and an encouraging one, where even our most distressed areas tend to at least be able to hold their own in terms of population. And a lot of this does have to do with not necessarily workers moving here like they do in our population centers, but retirees. And particular for the South Coast and Southern Oregon, where they get a lot of California retirees moving in. And this is something that a lot of distressed areas don't have and lends some hope for, you know, development in the future. So in general, though, you know, the economic outlook is pretty darn stable. The U.S. forecasters aren't really too worried about risk over the next year or so. The Wall Street Journal survey of professional forecasters puts the recessionary risk over the next year at about 15%, which is pretty low traditionally. And we're not seeing a lot of Chicken Littles out there running and saying that, you know, things are going to fall apart. But nevertheless, since we're in this old mature expansion, we know at some point it's going to end. And so we're increasingly starting to turn toward what are the potential risks out there and try to articulate what those look like.
Chair Haas, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, Josh Lehner, economist, Oregon Office of Economic Analysis. As Mark was saying, right, a lot of economists aren't putting a very high probability on the risk of recession in the near term, absent some sort of catastrophic event, a nuclear war or something crazy like that, right? And so the reason for that is that the data flow is all very, very good right now. There are hardly any worrisome signs in the current flow of information, whether it's employment or income or these leading indicators that you see some of them listed here. This is a compilation of our office's leading indicators for Oregon, and what Tim Dewey puts together in his University of Oregon economic indicator series as well. There's only one that's colored red in front of you, and actually if you look at the most recent data, which came out in the last couple of weeks, that red has been revised up to a yellow, right? There's nothing really concerning in the data flow at the U.S. level or in Oregon. And in particular, the good news has been that the manufacturing sector has turned around in the last 18 months. Following the oil bust that started in late 2014, all of our manufacturing indicators, hours worked, some of the temp help workers that fill some of the positions in the manufacturing sector, new orders for equipment and machines and things like that, all of those fell at a recessionary level, but the overall economy did not tank at the same time. Those have all reversed, and they've all turned around and are started growing again. So that's the really good news when it comes to a lot of these leading indicators. Now, the one that is sort of at the national level, people are pointing out and saying looks worrisome is the yield curve, or the difference between short-term interest rates and long-term interest rates. Right now, we have the Federal Reserve in a tightening cycle where they're raising those short-term interest rates. But the long-term interest rates, whether you want to look at 5-year, 10-year, 20-year, 30-year long-term interest rates, whichever one you want to pick, those aren't rising right now. And so that spread is narrowing, which looks concerning because when the yield curve inverts, when long-term interest rates are actually lower than short-term interest rates, That is a clear recessionary signal. It means it's actually better to hold on to your money today because you can get a better return on it relative to making an investment today, given the cost of financing and borrowing. And the yield curve inverts 1 to 2 years ahead of recession historically. Right now, the yield curve's flattening, so it looks bad, but what matters is the actual inversion. The yield curve was flat as a pancake from 1996 through 2000, right? So it can go flatter than it is today, and we still had a massive expansion and a strong economy throughout the late 1990s. And so, again, the inversion is what matters for the yield curve, not just drifting in that direction, because the drifting in that direction is normal for an economic business cycle as the economy matures and the Federal Reserve tightens. Now, the fact that the long-term interest rates aren't increasing over the last couple of years has a couple potential signals there that are potentially worrisome. The first one is as the economy continues to improve but long-term interest rates are not rising, maybe we are locked into this low-growth scenario that we've seen for the last 8 or 9 years, that maybe we can't really pull out of it in a significant way above the trends we've been seeing. The other one is a message to the Federal Reserve itself, is that if you continue to raise these short-term interest rates, but market participants don't believe the economy is strong enough to support it, the Federal Reserve will tighten into this relatively weak but still growing economy. And so then, therefore, that may be the cause of the next recession. And most economic forecasters, as of today, because the data flow is positive, that's kind of what they're pointing to, is that Federal Reserve policy may be the signal or maybe the cause of the upcoming recession, given everything else going on in the economy today. So that's a risk. The other risk, Mark was talking about all the good news we're seeing in population growth, and we are seeing positive ones, right? Basically, for the last 4 years, every county in Oregon has seen positive population gains, except for one, Grant County, John Day. They've basically flat for 2 years, 2 years up, 2 years down. But outside of that, what really has been interesting to watch has been the composition of this population growth. Given the stronger than expected population gains, we have raised our population forecast in our office. The long-term trajectory of Oregon's population has been raised ever so slightly. Here you see the 2026 numbers are up about 30,000, 37,000 people. So that's over 10 years. So cumulatively, 37,000 people, 3,000 extra a year. The composition of this is what makes it a risk. As we have the aging population, we're seeing more deaths in the economy, in the population, just because overall we're aging into some of our advanced years. However, we're also seeing fewer births than expected. So this natural increase, the difference between births and deaths, is shrinking over time. Now, this was expected. It's continuing to happen. However, the relative trends are a little bit steeper than we had previously thought. We're expecting even fewer births moving forward than we previously did, and we're expecting a little more deaths moving forward than we previously did. And so this natural increase is actually expected to turn negative in Oregon in 2029. So here in 15 years, or less than that, 12 years, deaths are actually expected to outnumber births, which is something we didn't have in our forecast previously, at least not this close. It was further out before that natural increase turned negative. Now, counteracting all of this is in a much larger, not necessarily much larger, but a stronger outlook for net migration. People picking up, moving to Oregon like they do each and every single year since Lewis and Clark and since the Bering Sea land bridge. People have been moving here to the Northwest ever since then. But this net migration trend is projected to be even stronger than our previous assessments. And that's what makes it a risk, is that we're fully reliant upon people picking up and moving here to grow our population. So to the extent that these migrants don't materialize and our population growth is slower than anticipated, that will change the long-run trajectory of our Oregon forecast, both for the economy and for tax revenue. So if migration flows dry up, our longer-term revenue forecast will be slower than it is.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Barber.
Thank you. Could you broaden that analysis a little bit? I'm guessing that that the deaths number has to do with the baby boom demographic bubble that we have. But that would be a national trend, not just a state one. I'm wondering how these numbers compare with the national numbers.
Chair Hass, Representative Barnhart, thank you. You're correct, right? These are trends that are seen everywhere. Ours are actually a little bit better. We've seen the natural increase, again, the births minus the deaths, has turned negative in a lot of locations across the country already. And in some of our rural communities here in Oregon, it is negative as well, where deaths outnumber the births. Where we're bucking that trend a little bit, particularly in rural Oregon, are places where we see a larger share of Hispanic or Latino households, where the births are higher than for the white population. And so we still expect to have better natural increase numbers than the U.S. more broadly. However, the composition of it looks to be a little bit worse or a little bit slower than our previous expectations were.
And if I could follow up, Mr. Chair, thank you. And of course, you have the big blue bar with the migration from other parts, I assume mostly from other parts of the United States. Other states don't have that happening. Somebody must be losing population for us to be growing it.
Chair Haas, Chair Barnhart, absolutely. That is correct. Our migration trends are among the strongest in the nation, and our population growth is expected to be above the U.S. average for the foreseeable future. What we're talking about here is not that Oregon will see worsening population trends relative to the rest of the country or relative to our western neighbors. It's that the composition of that growth has shifted a little bit based upon trends we're seeing in the last few years. These aren't surprise trends, right? We're expecting lower births moving forward and more deaths. It's just the relative magnitudes there have adjusted. And then offsetting that trends are that those migration numbers have come in above forecast basically for the last 4 years. And so we've been raising that migration forecast.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Boquist?
A follow-up to the same question. Josh, please don't answer today, but next quarter when you come in here and, you've been in the news quite a bit talking about this particular issue of migration. So I followed some of your articles and comments. Could you talk about next forecast, that composition piece? I mean, what is that composition piece? Because I think, as we all know, if you're getting retirees coming in, they're not helping the labor force. And if you're getting other types, there are certain portions of this composition that are worrisome in itself, that they don't actually help. They may, in fact, hinder. And actually been some interesting quotes from you in the newspaper in the past about this. So maybe next quarter you could address a slide on that composition so we can all get an understanding of what that composition looks like.
Chair Haas, Chair Barnhart. Senator Boquist, absolutely. We'll bring some. The composition of the migrants, is that the people moving to Oregon?
Okay, exactly.
Yeah. We'll do. Thanks.
Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to another thing, the other thing that I think about when I see that, particularly if most of our growth is going to be dependent on in migration, is what impact our ever-increasing housing costs all across the state are going to have on that, and whether that will serve as a deterrent to that in migration. Because it just, it's that, the line that you hear about companies from California and Washington move here because we're still so much cheaper than Seattle or San Francisco, but that's changing. And so I would appreciate any kind of thoughts that either briefly now or as another element to discuss.
Chair Haas, Chair Barnhart, Representative Smith-Warner, absolutely. And I think that is one of the biggest concerns with the affordability erosion. A couple points, and we can talk more about this next quarter as well, as it ties in to some of the implications of this migration trends. First is that affordability erosions are occurring throughout all major metropolitan areas that are growing in the U.S. While we think about it, we have rural affordability challenges too, which we've talked about. So it's not unique to us. The parts that are growing across the U.S. are all facing these same things. Now, the degree of the affordability problem seems to be a bit worse here in Oregon than in the other states, but they're still seeing some of the same trends. The other one is absolutely the concern here when it comes to the affordability is that we choke off these potential population gains, and if people aren't packing up and moving here because they want to live here, quality of life, job opportunities, things like that, if they're not coming here in the first place, that will slow our population forecast, and then that will translate into slower net economic growth and slower revenue growth moving forward. So I think that is a risk, particularly for the risk that our office deals with and you guys on your committees deal with, absolutely is a big concern, because it will change that whole 10, 20-year trajectory of the outlook should these migrants not materialize, and they could not materialize for a number of reasons, whether it's the economic growth, the job opportunities just aren't there, or maybe the affordability is to such a point that it's not – people choose not to move to Oregon.
So another risk we've been asked to weigh in on quite a bit lately is the impact of wildfires on our outlook. Unfortunately, the stuff that we can really put numbers to at this time in terms of the wildfire is kind of the boring pieces of it. We can quantify, you know, what the disruption to the trucking industry, for example, at $300,000 a day was of closing I-84. And we can talk about timber valuations and the like to try to value the timberland, but that's also not necessarily appropriate either. If you think about a place like the Columbia River Gorge that was never going to be logged, maybe the timber value is not necessarily that indicative of its true value. Someone could argue that the value of that timberland is zero because it would never be logged, or you could also argue the other side, saying, well, the reason it was never re-logged is because that's not its best use or its most valuable use, and so it's obviously much more valuable than the timber itself. Otherwise, we would have cut it down. And so, so that's difficult. But to quantify, you can look at timber values, and that's sort of where the courts have gone in similar cases. There was a Moonlight Fire in 2007 in Northern California, where a private logging operation started a fire that spread to public land. And in this court case, it was federal land, much like what burnt in Oregon this year. And so the federal government was asking for 10 times the timber value of that land because it was special and unique. The court ended up settling just for replacement value. What would it cost to go out there and buy that track back? And so we can look at that here in Oregon. Although each track is different, some of them didn't burn completely, and others you have to worry about the quality of the trees or the logging costs involved. For the gorge, for example, we know that they have a lot bigger and denser trees than the typical timber sale, but it would have been very expensive to log. You'd have to bring helicopters in and the like if you were actually to do it. But if you look over the last 3 years since 2014 at all the big timber sales, they really vary somewhere between $1,500 an acre to $6,000 an acre, somewhere averaged about $3,500 an acre or so. And so I think it's fair to say most of these fires were in land that was a little bit probably on the high end of that, if you just want the raw numbers. But again, those are the things we can quantify, aren't really the stuff that we are most worried about, the longer term effects and the permanent effects. And those are really in two parts. One is the disruption to small businesses that occurred, particularly in our tourist centers in the Gorge and Southern Oregon and Bend and the like. The issue being, while there were spillovers, particularly with the closure of I-84, we saw a lot of business move to other parts of the state, so it was maybe not such a great net loss. But nevertheless, it was a shock to a lot of small businesses, in retail and consumer services and sales. And the problem being, if you lose a couple of months or a month of your income, oftentimes for these places it was in their peak sales season, then they come up with cash flow problems as they go into the lean winter months, or they next year when they lose their roof or something, now they have capital problems because they lost the earnings in some peak seasons. And in terms of the numbers, that really did hit a lot of this smoke problem, really did hit in the peak seasonal hiring season for a lot of places. In Southern Oregon, the Chetco Bar Fire and the Horse Creek and Millie Fire in Central Oregon were it's right smack dab at the peak employment season for our seasonal industries. For the Gorge, it was a little bit after, but still in the fall, it was still inflated somewhat relative to the typical month. So that's where the governor's office and the policy folks at the Small Business Association and the like are reaching out, and where there is kind of a role to try to keep. Get capital to some of these small businesses to keep them afloat through, past the shock. But more broadly, what we're worried about is, okay, is now if it's perceived that we're going to have bigger and more frequent wildfires, and this is going to disrupt our economies, maybe shut down the Shakespeare Festival during the peak season, or
disrupt business travels to Oregon, or all the folks that come here in the summer and drive through the gorge and go hiking and love it and then decide to move back here in the winter when it's rainy and it's completely different, we may lose some of that. So the concern is, over time, are businesses and households going to be less likely to migrate because of a increased sense of risk? And of course, over time means we don't have data yet, but what economists do is we like to look at expectations through what markets price. In particular, investors do try to internalize the risk of the places they invest in, and that's more of an immediate thing, how these financial markets and bond markets respond. And so the chart I put up here looks at what Oregon municipal borrowers and borrowers have had to pay before and after the fires relative to borrowers in other states. The concept being, if Oregon is now perceived as more risky, well, then our municipalities and our districts, public water districts and like, are going to have to pay more money to borrow. But that doesn't seem to be happening yet. In fact, after the fire season, our borrowing rates have actually dropped relative to those in other states. Now, this is encouraging. It shows that, well, it doesn't look like there's a big investor response to these things out there in the data yet, but of course there's a whole lot of other things that go into these borrowing costs than wildfires alone. Which municipalities are borrowing? Is it a water district in Harney County, or is it a Lake Oswego school district? These are going to get different rates. Or also what's happening in other states. While we had wildfires, other states had potentially scarier events in terms of hurricanes and flooding and the like, which may have raised their risk premium relative to Oregon at the same time. But nevertheless, at least so far in the real-time data, we're not seeing indications that folks are afraid to relocate to Oregon yet.
Another concern, particularly when it comes to the forecast and the outlook, is any long-term risk in slower growth moving forward. And so when it comes to natural disasters and it comes to, what is the long-term impact, will people stop coming to Oregon? Will they stop going to the southern coast because of the Chetco Bar Fire? Will they stop going to the Shakespeare Festival? Will they stop coming to the gorge to hike and enjoy the breweries and all that stuff? And so we've kind of looked back historically to find some precedents for this. We kind of honed in on two of them from the 1980s. The first one was the Yellowstone fires in 1988, which was a massive set of fires on federally protected land. It's a tourism area, that sort of thing. And what you see when you compare visitation data to Yellowstone National Park relative to other big popular national parks across the country is there doesn't appear to be a long-term impact to visitation in these areas that saw the fires. There was a short-term impact in the 1 year of the fires. You can see there where the arrow is pointing to. People didn't go right when the fires were burning, but the next year they came back, and the year after that, and the year after that. And so the hope is, or the expectations may be, that tourism to the southern coast and maybe to Ashland and Medford and the Gorge and Portland may be down a little bit in the short term due to some of the natural disasters we've seen, but over the long term, it won't be a major impact. Again, that short-term cash flow issue for small businesses is most likely where we'll see some of these impacts, maybe not a long-run concern. It still is a risk, but looking at Yellowstone, at least this indication says possibly not.
Senator Boquist.
Just for your future consideration, since you're going back to the future, so far, I guess we can't drop the banana into the nuke machine and make the car run. Two points here for you. One is that the St. Helens and Yellowstone, we weren't in such a litigative society back then when these transpired. Let me give you two examples. All indications from the U.S. Forest Service is, and the Federalists, is that large swaths of the land in the gorge is not going to be available to public access because of a whole variety of environmental reasons. So people just won't be able to go there. Now, what that does mean, though, is people are going to come. I agree with you there. But there'll have to be a new place they're coming to. Second impact, I'll just give you a prime example, the Grizzly Fire, which is in across the river in Washington, in the southeastern corner of Washington, was heavily hit, and it was heavily hit especially in the pine beetle infestations, which, of course, you strike lightning on dry wood, it burns. Now,
pine beetle, like deer, are not stupid. They, you know, leave the tree, go with the smoke. And if you go now to the northern half of Wallowa County and its neighboring counties, you now see the massive pine beetle infestations that were originally across the river in Washington infecting our recreational areas and our private lands. The last point I'd make, which is a very interesting one from legalities for the lawyers sitting in the room, is the federal government does have the opportunity in federal court to sue private landowners who create losses on their land. But since the federal government gets to decide who gets sued, those of us who are losing serious tracts of timber to both fire and bug infestations off of federal land have no such recourse. So there's going to be a little bit different implications in the future today than what we had back then. And I think the downwind impact shall be slightly different. But as you point out, it'll be positive because people are going to come, they're going to go somewhere. Well, maybe the new recreational area is Detroit Dam in that area. It's going to be massively built up and they go there because they can't go to the gorge. And of course, that, as you well explained, is a shifting of economics. Let's just hope they don't go across the river. We want them to stay on our side. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. So perhaps the biggest, or the probably not perhaps, the biggest risk to the revenue outlook right now is has to do with federal tax reform, the changes that are happening at the federal level and how this feeds through to our revenue system. I know I'm going to just go through this briefly. I know that LRO did a good job of summarizing this for you guys in Legislative Days, and so I invite anyone to go back and look at that testimony for the details. But in general, we have to worry about, in our world, the biggest impact, of course, of tax cuts to Oregonian households and business is going to, what it's going to do to their own federal tax bills, right? They care about how much they pay federal tax bills. In our world, we care about Oregon revenues, and there are some real strong ties between the federal tax law and Oregon revenues. In fact, you know, we reconnect automatically with what we call a rolling reconnect to federal tax law changes here in Oregon, unless the legislature chooses to act, which they have in the past when there were revenue shortfalls. They've chosen not to take on some of the federal tax changes, in particular accelerated depreciation and the like, in order to support local revenues during downturns. But in the past, when we've seen big federal changes to tax law in the Reagan era and in Bush's tax cuts, both of those turned into real significant boosts in terms of Oregon's own source revenues. Although a secondary effect, you know, for households to what's going on in their federal tax bill, for us these are big impacts. And with the LRO numbers and some DOR numbers that are coming out now, depending, of course, the devil's in the details, what the federal tax plan actually looks like if it does get passed. But looking, you know, at skeletons of what they're talking about now, we're looking on the order of $150 or $200 million a year in additional Oregon revenue. And so $150, $200 million a year, when the kicker threshold over 2 years is $350 million, these are big numbers and things that are catching our attention. So really two ways that federal tax law feeds into Oregon's revenue stream. The biggest potential impacts are direct effects. And these direct effects come from efforts at the federal level to broaden the base. While the federal tax law is talking about cutting rates, they are also broadening the base by eliminating or reducing a broad range of deductions, subtractions, and the like, what you can write off your federal income. Well, for Oregon, the starting point of our Oregon taxes pretty much is federal taxable income. So a lot of these itemized deductions in particular are going to, if they're disallowed at the federal level and we reconnect automatically, that will disallow them at the Oregon level and increase tax liability here in Oregon significantly. And this is a big deal for Oregonians because we like our deductions. Both low-income households and high-income households alike itemized deductions more than they do at the U.S. level and for larger amounts. And why is this? A lot of it has to do with one particular deduction, which is the state and local tax deduction. Ignoring the property taxes, you know, this is relatively big in Oregon,
5% of our AGI in 2015 were, written off due to this state and local tax deduction. So once you make this one big one, it now makes it more favorable or more likely that a tax filer will itemize. And therefore, all of our itemized deductions tend to be bigger than other places in the U.S. We itemize a lot more than just largely because of this one, because this one is big enough to make it worthwhile for a lot of taxpayers to itemize. So the direct impact, we worry about, okay, well, to the extent that this base is broadened, this can feed straight into Oregon revenues. There are also indirect impacts, which are sometimes scary large, too. Oh, sorry, yeah. The indirect impacts being predominantly from the fact that you can write off your federal taxes paid on your Oregon taxes. And so anything that broadly lowers your federal tax bill lowers the amount that you can write off your Oregon taxes, and therefore put positive upward pressure on Oregon tax revenues. And so we're seeing that as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If a tax bill is passed at the federal level, can I assume during January ledge days we'll get some sort of briefing about what the actual implications are? Because it seems like it's a moving target every day. It's changing a little bit. And then the second thing I was curious, did you say if this some change goes through and it increases the revenue that we collect because certain deductions are no longer available, you made it sound like that causes something with the kicker? That's not anything we did.
That was poorly Chair Haas, Representative Nose. I was trying to put it in perspective. there are a lot of moving parts to the kicker. This would be just one of them. So all else equal,
okay,
right? Just to put it into magnitude in terms of the size of our general fund. And yes, it does impact the kicker. When we set the close of session forecast in May, and then and locked in the forecast for these 2 years, there wasn't an assumption like this of a tax bill in there. So should that be passed, that would be additional revenue over and above what was forecast. So all else equal, we're starting to get into that sort of territory.
Does our state constitution allow us to, by statute, amend the kicker law and say we didn't foresee the federal government making a big tax change, and ergo we shouldn't have to? I know a lot of this is constitutional, but
yes, Representative Nose, the kicker calculation is just always remember it's two numbers. It's the close of regular session, and that language is in the Constitution. Close of regular session, the estimate, the base that Mark and Josh gave you in September, that's the base compared to what actually comes in the door that we won't know until August of 19.
Which
so it's those two numbers.
Somebody didn't have the foresight to know that
Donald there was going to be some. Exactly. So there's okay. there's no allowance for that. So you make the calculation. The one thing you do have the power to do in the legislature is you can with a 2/3 vote, you can quote change the estimate. So basically, okay. What you would do if you got the 2/3 vote, you would tell us or tell LRO to calculate, give us a number to make sure that we are over the threshold or whatever number you want, and then or with the number that includes the federal estimates, and then you could change the estimate on a one-time basis with a 2/3 vote.
Okay.
That's the mechanism.
All right,
Chair Haas. Yeah, and while we have Dr. Warner here. I think there's some similarities to what happened with the MUPL, and we're going to lose all of this institutional knowledge when we lose Dr. Warner. Yes, what is a MUPL?
Yes.
What's a MUPL? Off the record.
It's an endangered species. No.
Oh, okay. It's like a snipe.
The MUPL. The MUPL occurred. Actually, the MUPL occurred just prior to the kicker calculation going in the Constitution. It was in the last biennium under statute, which is 9901. There was a mechanism by which federal dollars came in that were above what expenses were that were incurred by DHS, I believe. So it was kind of a flow of dollars that didn't have anywhere to go. So they were just showing up in the general fund. as general fund dollars, and it ended up being over $100 million. So that pushed us well above the kicker. We were above the kicker anyway, but it added to the kicker. So the legislature did make a decision at that time, was under a statutory decision to reduce, to take that MUPL money and make it another fund dollars and not general fund, not part of the kicker. That decision was upheld by the courts and Bobo versus Golengoski. So that we do have some precedent of that. But again, that was federal dollars. It was not income tax dollars.
That's right.
That's right. I have a question, but before I have a statement for the record, since we decided we're going to make this political. This has happened previously in Democrat administrations when they've cut taxes, and there is a Blue Dog Democrat proposal for cutting taxes, too. So I guess we'll have to wait and see how it comes up. But I have a question of your slide up there to make sure I understand. The graph to the right-hand side is a breakdown of the deductions, which, correct me if I'm wrong, shows that the highest use of deductions in the state of Oregon are in the Portland metro area, Corvallis, and Deschutes County, correct?
Yes, Senator Boquist, these are in dollar values per claimant. So, yes, high-income areas, there are over $3,000 per filer being written off your taxes.
Thank you.
There's a few Republicans that live in those
areas. Not as many,
Senator Boquist, but there's some. I run into them in really good grocery stores.
This is bipartisan. You and I both agree. Okay. We've had this discussion.
So, one more thing to add. Again, the devil's in the details about what comes out. But in addition to these direct and indirect flows that come from the federal tax law straight into Oregon tax law, we also have to worry about behavioral impacts. In particular, when we're cutting personal income tax rates on pass-through entities, even more so, we have to, and making these potentially temporary, we have to worry about people shifting their income across time. In particular, if we think that in personal or individual income tax rates are temporary, folks are going to pull investment income into that time, and small businesses are going to realize more and more of their income in that period of time. And so this even exacerbates the issue of potentially, you know, swelling our revenues during this expansion. But right now, we don't have a lot of that in the baseline. There isn't a lot of this shifting around. There is some in terms of capital gains we pulled in there under the assumption that there was going to be some individual tax cut, but nothing on the order of what would probably ensue after the plans that they're talking about now. So for the revenue update and outlook, as with the economics, we're tracking pretty well, but things are slowing down somewhat in terms of growth.
Just as we were talking about at the very beginning, where the economy has slowed in the jobs data, we're certainly seeing it in the income data too. Here's withholding out of Oregonians' paychecks. It's an incredibly noisy series. People get paid daily, hourly, weekly, monthly, and so we've tried to smooth it a little bit. This is the smooth version you see in front of you, but it's clear we've decelerated over the last couple of years. Withholding has gone from 7 or 8% on a regular basis down to 5 or 6%, which is still significantly faster than in the other states. So we're still seeing good growth. It's just a little bit slower, which matches with what we're seeing in the employment data. Employment went from 3.5% year-over-year job growth down to 2 to 2.5% where we are today. So these patterns match, even if the month-to-month movements, both in this income data and certainly in the employment data series, might show wilder swings. When you look at it in the big picture perspective, there's no question we're still growing and outperforming the typical state. It's just we're transitioning down from peak growth rates to something more sustainable over the longer term, or at least that's what's built into our forecast, and it's come into fruition relatively well in recent years.
So as a result, our outlook for the current biennium has not changed much. Here you see combined general and lottery fund resources up just under $50 million for the current biennium relative to the forecast that was made 3 months ago. Things are pretty stable here. This growth relative to the close of session, you see the close of session is May plus the red part, which are the revenue enhancements that were passed by the legislature during the session. We're above that a little bit now, but all that is due to additional lottery funds in terms of our basic general fund income. Corporate personal income taxes are right on par with what was expected at that time when the budget was
crafted. So just a little bit more lottery resources is really the main change since the budget was written. Going forward, we expect bigger increases relative to the September forecast, $160 million in 1921, and $108 million in 21-23, and $124 million in 23-25. Really two parts to this. The biggest is this increase in corporate, the outlook for corporate tax collections. While corporate tax collections are tracking the forecast really well, corporate profits are coming in above forecast pretty regularly, and the outlook for them has, from our vendor, has been revised up. And so larger growth in corporate profits throughout the forecast period and the out years here is translating into some significant revenues as we go forward. There's also in the near term some impact to personal income taxes, some increases in the personal income tax collections. And a lot of that has to do with what we saw during the extension filing period. In the fall, a lot of Oregonians who are high-income households turn in their tax returns. Although they make their payments in April, just like everyone else, when you have a big, complicated return, they tend to be amended or extended into the fall before they actually turn them in. And so we've finally processed these and started to have a couple surprises this year. In particular, it was a really big year for these year-end, not necessarily payments and collections, but the reporting of income. There was in two parts. There was a lot more wages. Again, these are typically the high-income households. There are a lot more wages than there typically are that are reported at the end of the year relative to what's been reported before. And there was a whole lot of pass-through income, particularly stuff on your Schedule E. So that's rental income, S-corporations, partnerships, stuff like that. We really never seen such a big end of the year relative to what was going on before, which was already a really big year for this sort of pass-through income. And so this has increased this, you know, our perception of the size of overall tax liability in Oregon today, and so this carries forward somewhat into the outlook.
Senator Buchholz?
I'm just curious, because that is a fairly significant change. You guys have any guess of why, we'll just say, more affluent individuals are taking money as wages versus dividends or anything? Like, any idea why you think they're doing that?
Yeah. Sorry, Chair Haas, Senator Boquist. Yeah, that remains an open question in terms of this year and the reporting. When we asked this of our accounting group, and whatnot, and they do believe that I think some of it has to do with just the increase of the amount of growth in this stuff. Now, wages less so, but wages are just bigger. But in particular with that Schedule E, it's been growing so fast over the past few years and arguably concentrated in high-income individuals that we're just seeing numbers like we haven't before in terms of what's coming in at the end. Wages a little less certain in terms of what's going on, why people would defer and wait. I picked through the data a little bit, looking at folks that were subject to measure the higher rates, measure 66, and those who weren't. And over the last year, the Measure 66 types did see significantly faster wage growth than others in terms of the tax returns. Now, that hasn't been borne out in our income data, so it was a bit of a surprise. Okay. So with our biennial revenue growth, The story remains the same as with the economy. We're, you know, transitioning down to a more long-term sustainable rate of growth here. The missing tooth there in 17-19 is the result of paying out a kicker. We have a kicker going out in the next tax period, and which reduces it by $460 million. If not for that reduction, this deceleration would look much smoother than it does here in the picture.
Question. How about this? Sorry. In previous presentations, you've talked about lottery revenue, and we were worried about the casino that was opening in the state of Washington. And I just kind of scanned through the slides to see if that was going to be a thing or not. Are we doing better or about the same or can't?
Yes, Chair Haas, Representative Nose. Yes, so far the numbers are still coming in above forecast in terms of lottery sales. And this, in particular, the impact that we expected that the Alinea Casino, the Cowlitz Casino in La Center, Washington, was going to have, still appear to be much smaller for us and for Spirit Mountain and the like than we projected. So far, we've cut about around half of that expected impact out of the forecast. So we've raised the forecast back up, taking away about a half of this shock away. But so far, it hasn't even been a half. So we're waiting to see if they build a hotel and a buffet and all that. Maybe we will get what we expected. But so far, no. And so I think there is still some upside risk here to the lottery forecast. If sales don't slow and we decide that this casino really wasn't a big deal, and we've already decided it's only half as big a deal as we thought it was going to be, there is still some upside risk here.
And benefit of traffic.
Yeah, food, bed, yeah. Service. And stop suggesting they build a hotel.
You didn't hear it here.
Okay. Well, the traffic is maybe that's why people don't want to drive
it. Yes, we've heard the traffic is
no bridges.
Apparently, the ownership group of the casino, the Mohegan Sun Group or whatever, had some really big debt loads going, and they had to get the doors open and start getting some money in. And so they might not have been ready for prime time when they rolled out. So we're still holding out the potential that their sales will increase and will be a bigger draw for our or away from our video lottery.
The fear of potential. We don't want any potential here.
That's right. So reserves. This is the good story here. Won't talk about much of it, but we're up at 8% of biennial revenues now, far more than we've ever saved again. These automatic deposit mechanisms that the legislature put in, the lottery for the Education Stability Fund, and the corporate tax revenues and ending balance going into the Rainy Day Fund have really started to pay dividends. And like I say, now this isn't enough to brunt a full-on recession, but it'll certainly take some of the sting out relative to our past experience, and we're getting there. If we keep having a couple more of these years, we're going to have even larger reserves until we start hitting the upper limits at around fiscal 23 is when we start hitting these caps, legislated caps on our reserve funds that are in place now. So on to retirements. We talked about this in front of this group about a year ago now. Put up this graph and some other stuff about this aging baby boom population cohort, and this is part of our stump speech that we give everywhere. We talk about, we're going to see, we can't expect the same sort of rates of growth going forward that we've become accustomed to because we have all of these baby boom population cohort workers entering their retirement years and leaving the labor force. And not only are all the large number of folks leaving the labor force, but these aren't just anybody. These are highly productive workers with a lifetime of experience. And unfortunately, they're replaced by younger, less experienced folks that don't do quite as good of a job, and so this is this is go. Really
oh my goodness
close to home.
I don't know if there's like no millennials in the
for house. Us, yeah.
where's Representative Hernandez?
Josh here.
yeah. Well, yeah. So making it worse, Paul isn't the only sensei leaving the dojo. We also last month said goodbye to Tom Petoskey, who retired from Portland State University. He still has his research center part-time, but he's no longer chair of the department. And so these two, having served for 10 years each, both the longest-serving state economists, are both just really invaluable mentors. And they say they'll still answer our calls and everything, but I'm not 100% sure that they'll be as responsive as they have been in the past. But so So this is something that scared us, and we started to look at the history of, it's a good time to step back and look at the history of our office now that we're losing the grandfather and the father of the Office of Economic Analysis. We have in the room today, we have the last 28 years of state economists are all sitting here, so that's a lot of beans counted, so around 200 billion beans. 200 billion $1 bills would wrap around the earth 800 times. So that's a lot of beans we've counted to date. Sometimes we've done a little bit better job than others. I'll let Josh speak to this.
We couldn't let Paul and Tom leave without compiling some statistics on the records that have come. Because after all, our office is tasked with forecasting revenues. And so what this shows you are a few statistics we've thrown together for close of session forecasts for the personal kicker and the corporate kicker only. Only those May forecasts in the odd years. And the most important thing is, from a forecasting perspective and bringing good news to policymakers such as yourselves, is being able to thread the needle and hit that sweet spot where revenues come in right at forecast or a little bit above it, ideally, so there's a little bit more money for to help with the budget, but below that kicker 2% threshold. And over our office's existence, going on nearly 40 years, not quite 40 years now, that has happened twice in our history. Just one indication of how hard it is to hit that sweet spot. Paul did it with his very first close of session forecast ahead of 91-93 on the personal side, not on the corporate side. And it took us more than 20 years to come up with as an accurate forecast as what Paul did in May of 1991. And so the two times that's happened, again, it happened most recently in 11-13, and we'll let Tom and Mark fight about who gets credit for that one. And so then we move over to the second column of statistics, the EKA, kind of like an ERA from baseball, your earned kicker average. Out of how many opportunities you had to earn a kicker, how many did you actually give out? And Paul had a pretty high kicker average. Seven out of 10 times of his closing session opportunities resulted in an income tax kicker. However, you'll notice that his median error was just over 2%, and he saw no recessions on his watch. That's the biggest thing when it comes to forecast accuracy is that business cycle. So Paul's experience was he underestimated the economy throughout the 1990s, but by just a little bit every couple years, right? They came in just a little bit above forecast. And so we saw kicker after kicker after kicker after kicker. It's just they were really, really small numbers relative to it. Now Tom succeeded Paul. And the economy in the 2000s was significantly more volatile, significantly harder to predict than what we saw in the 1990s. And so Tom has some large forecast errors. In fact, the closest session from 2001 is the forecaster's worst nightmare. At that time, growth was starting to slow. You built some slower growth into the forecast, right? Things were starting to taper off following the dot-com bubble. But we didn't know we were in a recession. Now the recession is judged to have started in March of 2001, so 2 months prior to the release of that forecast. But you didn't necessarily know that at the time. Again, the growth had slowed, but we hadn't plunged into recession. And that's also the first time. So the forecast was up a little bit, but the fact the revenues were down. And then coming out of that was the housing bubble. And the wild swings we saw in the 2000 with capital gains in particular was something we really hadn't seen before, hadn't seen in quite some time. So the capital gains with the dot-com bubble, the housing bubble, and now here in the most recent years, this is a new animal that our office has had to deal with in the last 15 years in particular. Tom might have had some larger errors to his forecast, but as a result was they were pretty balanced if you do the pluses and the minuses overall, and so his earned kicker average was a little bit lower than what our office has typically done because of the volatility in the cycle. And with that, we have a couple concluding remarks about Paul and Tom a little bit more.
Yeah, what I think this really illustrates is I like to say, well, the forecast never really hits the economy. The economy hits the forecast. And what I mean by that is, you know, given this office and the fact that, you know, we're trying to make a forecast for the whole state and be objective and nonpartisan and the like, we're never going to be way out on an outlier, you know, in terms of, you know, forecasts out there. We're not going to be way more optimistic or way more pessimistic than the general consensus. We're going to move around that trend to a certain extent. And so when we do get these big events, big swings up or down, those really aren't going to be captured given our process. You know, our process is really going to try to come up with something a little bit more mainstream in terms of the outlook. And so when the outlook turns out a little more mainstream, then we appear more accurate in terms of the numbers. But no one's been more accurate than Dr. Warner. And as good as his numbers were, his narrative, when I read through all these old reports, was even more spot on. The stuff he writes back then about migration trends and about the threats to rural Oregon and the transition from old line manufacturing to new line manufacturing, you could dust it off and put it in our reports today, and it has aged incredibly well. And you know, so many things he said were very, very prescient. That said, you know, when you dig through hard enough to troll him, I could find a few stupid things over time that did come up. The spotted owl, he missed the impact of that about threefold in terms of how much it was going to hit our timber supply. And in there, just in his last forecast, he was expecting a big turnaround in our agricultural industries and our tech hiring in the early 2000s that we were going to see, in particular, as you see here, the major expansions from 2000 to 2005 in the semiconductor industry didn't quite come to pass as expected. But that said, digging through this stuff, it really did just reinforce how good he was. Because for every one of these, I could find every stupid comment, I could also find three or four of them that were spot on and salient today. I just wish we had electronic versions of this, because I could cut and copy and paste some of this stuff into our document today, and it would be much more elegantly worded than we're doing now.
And finally, for Tom, we're not going to let him go unscathed either. He had a great quote that was given to an editorial board shortly after he left, when he went back to Portland State a handful of years ago. And he said the sweet spot, or the ideal forecast from our office is something like up $50, $70 million a quarter, right? Come in, we tell you the economy is still expanding, you have a little bit more money in the budget to help with unforeseen events. What I think he missed when he said that as his quote was that if you string eight quarterly increases of $50 or $70 million in a row, when you do the ideal forecast every single time, that's a kicker, guaranteed, right? And so I think that was an interesting thing that he said on his departure. But then we'll compare that with one of the best forecasts. There's no question economists, and our office in particular, we struggled mightily with the Great Recession, and then that flowed directly through to tax collections and the budget problems and issues that you guys dealt with on a daily and quarterly basis during that time period. However, once we hit bottom, and it was a very, very severe bottom, we've done a pretty good track record, starting with Tom and continuing with Mark, of forecasting this expansion coming out. The ride down was rocky and was terrible, but the ride out has been relatively close to expectations. And on our blog, our office blog, Tom wrote one thing. Over the years, he just wrote one post on that, and it came in the summer of 2010. And he titled it Bottom Fishing with No Bait. And he said, at that time, the economy has stopped getting worse, but things aren't going to get better for quite some time. And it's going to take 48 months for us to regain all of our job losses that we lost during the Great Recession. It's going to take us 48 months. Well, if you look at the chart in front of you today, based on the currently published data, it took 55 months, right? And so, again, from that rock bottom place, and he pulled up music in front of this committee. You know, when you're laying flat on your back, everything looks up. I don't know if some of you guys remember that. Where it took him a couple quarters to figure out how to get the media to work. But so that was probably one of the best things he did. And he took a lot of grief during the time period with the Great Recession. And when he said the recession was over, but it's going to be a slow, real recovery, the internet section, comment section went crazy. They were posting his home address and how to get to it, you know, like threatening, like all sorts of stuff was going on because the economy was so bad. And so I think even in that time of trial, that was probably one of the best forecasts that was produced under his watch. And so for that, one thankful for Paul's tenure, Tom's tenure here, both in our office and with the Legislative Revenue Office. We're all better off for their years of service, and thank you.
We truly are. Well, with that, that's it for us today, unless there are further questions.
Thank you, gentlemen. Any further questions on this report? Okay. Thank you. You guys can sit tight if you'd like. You know, they say economists don't have a sense of humor. So.
But they have to put it in a slide to remember.
Yeah, that's right.
So, even if it takes two quarters, Tom.
Yeah.
We do have, I want to say, make some time for our members to make some comments here about Dr. Warner. As you know, he's been the legislative revenue officer for 18 years.
Wow.
10 years prior, he was a state economist. And today is his 105th quarterly economic revenue forecast. And I think a lot of what we all know about Paul and appreciate almost doesn't even need to be said because it's just so obvious. But I do want to share one story that I think personifies who he is. A year or so ago, in the beginning of the session, we had I had two young people join my office, and I said, look, you know, a lot of what the work that I'm going to be doing is revenue, so you need to bone up on revenue issues. And so they went and camped out in Paul's office, and I didn't realize that this went on for hours, and he was teaching these young 20-somethings, you know, Oregon Finance 101. And so I sent him an email saying, thanks, Paul, for spending so much time with these young people. And he replied, helping young people is the best part of my job.
Aww.
And I think that that is who he is. It is not just, you know, meetings with governors and meetings with us. It is really who he is. So, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. And I hope other members have stories that they like to pass along as well. And I appreciate the opportunity to do that. I've been thinking now for a couple of months since Paul announced that he was going to retire about what to say at a meeting like this. And of course, he and I have worked together for a decade since I've been chair of the House Revenue Committee. And trying to encapsulate that in a minute or two is really hard. But let me say that your story really epitomizes the good faith at which Paul addresses his job. This job is a difficult one because you've got 90 masters, all of whom have different ideas about what we ought to do, all of whom have some really great ideas and some really screwball ones, and I've had my share of the latter. I let other people decide whether I had any of the former. And yet he is able, has been able, to address seriously all the issues raised by the members coherently with a clear, with the ability to clearly describe what the potential implications are of the proposals that he's been offered, and then make some counterproposals of his own that he thinks might actually get to the members' objective even better than the one that the member brought. And that's true whether it's been a liberal democratic idea or a conservative Republican idea or what have you. And I think an even harder task than doing that is the ability to keep it all straight, not tell me what Senator Boquist's brilliant idea was, unless Senator Boquist says it's okay for him to talk about it with me. I have never heard a confidence expressed, another member's confidence expressed to me, and of course, to do this job as a nonpartisan expert, head of one of the two major expert agencies in the legislature, is not an easy trick. It has, I'm sure, at times been difficult, very challenging. work, and yet Paul has made it look easy the whole time that that I have known him. We have worked on very complex legislation, some of which we got passed and some of which we didn't. I remember one of the most controversial pieces, not controversial, that's wrong, most complex pieces that we worked on was right at the beginning of the time that Representative Benson, I'm sorry he's gone off someplace, came on, and I asked him to work on, there he comes, and I asked him to work on the natural resources estate tax issue. Paul and his office did a fantastic job of dealing with an extremely complex issue over a period of about 3 years, and it's a demonstration of how well that got managed, that we have heard almost nothing about it in the last six or seven years, and we would have had that not been managed so well by the office. Now, Representative Bentz gets credit for a bunch of what happened, but without the office that that Paul has headed and staffed, he's hired most of the people who work in the office, haven't you?
Mm-hmm.
All of them, all of them, all the people, and of course, their quality is a statement of his quality. It seems to me as a person who understands the role that he plays, who's really good at it, and who also manages to hire crackerjack staff to do the work that he can't possibly do all on his own. So, Paul, I want to really thank you for the work you've done. I have to tell you, I understand the desire to retire. I'm very unhappy about the fact that you've chosen to take now to do it, because I'd like to keep you another 5 years or so. But I understand it, and I recognize it, and I want to congratulate you for the wonderful legacy that you have given the office. Your successors will be able to look back on this period of time as an example of how they should manage the office. And I want to, on my own behalf, and I hope on the behalf of the two committees, I want to thank you for that work. And I hope some other people will have some comments about Paul before we leave today.
Senator Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Haas. So, Dr. Warner, a couple things I wanted to comment on is that I hope you realize that the impact you've had far outside the building. So just yesterday, I'm on the Hunger Free Task Force, and Senator Rosenbaum chairs that. And it's a very big task force. There's all sorts of people there and all sorts of subcommittees and et cetera. And we had our meeting yesterday, and then there was a lunch afterwards. And all of a sudden, for some reason, your retirement came up in conversation. And I think that more than half the lunch, people sat around and talked about you and the work that you had done and et cetera, and how complicated it is and what we're going to do about revenue and how we're going to get more money for the state and all the different things that you had done, and all sorts of people there that I really don't know but have worked with you. They're senior to me, and they have worked with you over the years. So I hope that you realize that your work has extended far beyond just the building. And then the second thing is much more personal, that at the beginning of the session this year, I had a bill to get rid of the carried interest loophole, and you were the only person in the building who understood what I was talking about and agreed with me. I shouldn't say you agreed with me. Well, helped me find the supporting evidence to get rid of it. We were not able to do that, but I just warmed my heart that there was one other person in the building who understood why it is that we should get rid of the carried interest loophole. So I just want to thank you for everything that you've done, Dr. Warner. So,
Senator Brookwood.
Thank you. I mean, I first met Paul when we were in the majority in the House, so it was a little bit different. So I won't speak about those 2 years that I was over there, and those were, you know, some interesting days. Paul is the one who is not afraid behind the scenes. And I would say LRO has a reputation of being a bipartisan organization since I've been here more than a decade. And I don't say nonpartisan, because it's very hard to say nonpartisan. Paul is completely politically correct, and all of his staff are completely politically correct when they're sitting there.
I can assure you, when the senior members and leadership and ranking members here have been in private meetings with Paul, he's not overly unbashful to tell us that all four of us are stupid, that this is really a dumb idea, okay? You shouldn't do this, right? Because a lot of ideas come out, and there's some not ranking members who've been in the room and had those opportunities. So, and the nice thing about Paul is when you go in there, and I can literally say this, whether you're in the majority or the minority, he makes sure that you got the information you wanted, and he is not bashful to tell you that, yes, he understands, but it's never going to happen. Or, yes, you know, here's the deal, so on and so forth. And that has been a very, you know, beneficial, especially at least on the Senate side I can speak. I mean, we have had equal access in the minority and the majority to getting it, and Paul, of course, has managed to thread the needle, just like our state economists have, out in public of, you know, trying to be, you know, nonpartisan and so on and so forth along that line. And that's been, you know, a benefit. I think the most intriguing thing for Paul Warner, not Dr. Warner, Paul Warner, is that to see his blog or comments after he gets his first retirement check and he's sure it's real, then he's going to tell a true story. I think that is going to be the most interesting thing. Because I remember Tom leaving these facilities and Tom leaving the state, and some of the comments he made when he went to Portland State were very intriguing about the whole process. So I think the future is going to be the most interesting thing about Paul, not the past.
Thank you. Representative Mills.
As one of the newer members of the legislature and the Revenue Committee, I'll just say, I didn't get to work with you super lot, but one of the things I appreciated is that I feel like you were a very good explainer of things. I'm not a tax economist or, you know, an accountant, and I often struggled with a lot of these concepts, trying to figure out how to understand them and make them work with my politics and the concerns of my constituents. And I just appreciated that I could sit and listen to you and get a pretty good understanding of what I was going to be voting on or what I was trying to understand and know how to sort of vote or navigate it. And so that is something I just really, really appreciated. You know, you're very professorial, but you were, you know, it was fun to listen to you, and you were a good explainer of a lot of things that I didn't always feel like I understood, at least initially. And I hope you'll come back and regale Representative Hernandez and I with a sermon about Joyce and Finnegan, because we both talk a lot about it and how important that was. So.
Yes, Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I think building on what was just said by Representative Nose, I think your greatest trait is your ability to take a perfectly idiotic question and change it into something that makes some sense. And not that you've ever had any of those questions from anybody ever at this panel, at least not today yet. But that trait is really, really valuable. And I think you have a future taking perhaps Kellyanne Conway's place or Sarah Huckabee. There's some opportunity there.
I haven't been offered.
You haven't been offered that position. The other thing that I want to go back to that estate tax thing, because it's been hugely valuable to my part of the state, unbelievably valuable in keeping ranches together. So we appreciate that work. I was just working on a case 2 days ago in Ontario, and I actually went and got my cousin Clint's summary of it out and went through it with them to show that we actually did something in this building that helped, which is another challenge that I face often. But I just want to thank you so much for your work. It's been wonderful. And the fact that we can trust your answers is probably the most, absolutely the most important thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you. Well, he does have a pretty good EKA rating.
Yeah, he does.
Yes, he does.
Okay.
I make one further.
Sure.
One further comment. I've neglected to, and I don't. No one else has said it, so I want to. One of the things that we have to do is try to explain these very esoteric kinds of issues that we deal with constantly. Some of which, as has already been pointed out, we don't understand very well. Paul has been extremely available and helpful when it comes time for an explanation to the public about the issues that we deal with. He has been to my district several times and to other people's districts several times to town hall meetings or other events where he's been the key draw. And he's been able to do exactly what Representative Noss said he was able to do with Representative Noss, and that was to explain to ordinary citizens what it is we're about, how these systems work, and to some extent why they work the way they do and what the effects of them are. I have to say that, and of course this was almost all of these meetings were on his own time. They were after hours. He had to travel long distances. As far as I know, he didn't get paid anything extra for doing it. But he considered it to be part of the job. And I really, really appreciate. He also made me look good, which of course I also appreciate. But the fact is, he understands that his job here has meant more than the things we just were talking about, but also this public aspect too, in which he is really a fantastically good explainer. And I appreciate the chance to take a second shot, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Okay. Well, Dr. Warner, parting comments after 105 of these forecasts?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I'd like to say a couple things. I really appreciate all of your comments today. I've gotten some really nice cards from a number of members past and present that I really appreciated, and emails from people I haven't heard from for a while, and so that's been really nice. But, you know, I have to say that I'm very lucky to get to do something I love to do. So. So, you know, I've gotten to do too much of it at times, and that's been difficult, but, you know, I mean, I loved being state economist. I loved teaching for a while, this is a job I wanted.
Well,
So I appreciate that. I want to say thank you to everybody. In the building, I mean, Department of Revenue folks and all the folks in the building, the members. It's been past and present. It's been great, and I really appreciate working with the LAC staff, and it's been a great experience. I do want to say a special thanks to the folks who had to put up with me the most and always had my back, because staff of legislative revenue. Thanks for getting a chance to work with them. And people keep asking what I'm going to do, and you know I'm not sure what I'm going to do. But I do know the thought of having some time to think about what I'm going to do, and then actually have time to do it. Pretty appealing.
Yeah.
And if I run out of things, you know, I have people that I'm sure will guide me, such as my wife, who I'm now sometimes referred to as Madam Chair. Keep me busy. I'm looking forward to that. And,
that's hilarious.
So run for office.
Yes. Yeah. So I do want to say that. You know, after all, I'm not sure what I'm going to do because I've never been retired before. But I do want to say, too, that this is a really special place, and it's been great to be a part of it and to be a part of working with Office of Economic Analysis and everyone here, and I'll never forget it. And it's I feel really fortunate.
Good luck. All right. Well, your House Revenue Committee and Senate Revenue Committee wanted to send you off into retirement with a token of our love and appreciation. So I think we might need to bring you down in front here.
Okay. And don't anybody leave. There will be photographs.
Oh, wow. Look at it. That's really nice. That's nice.
Oh, my God.
Since you're such a rock star to us,
oh.
A rocker, you might want to try it and make sure it fits.
Okay. All right. It's on the deck. And
that works.
The acting band, see that? Look at that.
Why don't we stand?
Yeah, let's stand.